Hi, filling in for your friendly neighborhood, Andre Harrison. We are RJ O'Connell and Ryan Eric King, and welcome to episode 195. Jesus Christ, I can't believe we've been doing this long. Of the Motorsport 101 podcast. And you've been doing this longer than I have, King.
Yep, I've been here almost every episode. Oh, Lord.
God, it still feels like yesterday that I just happened to stumble into a guest appearance, and I'm now here as your full-time co-host and podcast editor. Oh, this is going to be a long, long week. We're here for episode 195, where, among many other things, we're going to be talking about a Monaco Grand Prix that was, I guess it was all right. I mean, if you grade it on a curve, but of course, where there was not a lot of racing action, there were plenty of stories to talk about away from the main race itself and the first leg, the first official leg of Day of Classics 4, for Ford's sake.
Yeah, like if I had to like quickly boil down the Monaco Grand Prix to like one statement, I'd say there was a lot, tons of buildup, very little payoff.
Right, but there was, of course, more than just Formula 1. We had Formula 2 there as well. We'll talk about all the action that happened there, including a phenomenal photo finish in the Saturday sprint race between Antoine Hubert and Louis Delatraz that came down to just 59/1000ths of a second. Trust me, much better finish than the Formula 1 payoff. I know we're setting tone early and giving our fans reason to listen in by just downplaying one of the biggest races of the year. We have Formula E from Berlin as Lucas Degrassi and Audi take a dominant victory at Tempelhof. And, of course, we have many other races to talk about, including the Coca-Cola 600, Super GT at Suzuka, Supercars at Winton, and even some word on a growing alliance.
Oh, God. We're just going to be in one big car company now.
That's right. We just got to accept that one third of the Formula One teams could potentially be owned by the same consortium if this merger goes through. So we've got all of that, and we'll talk about it as well, and we'll talk about it on the show. Of course, places you can find us, all of your Motorsport 101 related needs are at motorsport101.com. We are on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. And if you wish to follow us personally, you can at Harrison101HD. That's for Dre, who is still on vacation. Dre will be back here for our next bit of episodes. I am RJ O'Connell on Twitter. Ryan is Ryan Eric King. That's with two Ks. And of course, viewers and listeners like you can back us financially at patreon.com/motorsport101. For just $5 a month, you get early access to all of our shows. And for just $10 a month, you can listen to every show live as it's being recorded. It's a little bit later than usual. Of course, real life got in the way of that, but we still got a good crowd of Charlie listening in from Canada, Cam listening in with gauze in his mouth, Steven is here, and Rezzy is here at some, well, more civilized time of morning in Indonesia. Yeah, so you can be a part of that for just $10 a month, backing us on patreon.com/motorsport101. Now, last week, we recorded our episode in the build-up to the Indianapolis 500 and the Monaco Grand Prix, and shortly after we recorded, we learn the sudden and tragic passing of Andreas Nicholas Lauda, who we knew as Niki Lauda. After we take a short break, we'll look back on the life and the legacy of one of Formula One's greatest champions. Niki Lauda left us last Monday. He was 70 years old. He had been battling through numerous complications with his health, including a recent double lung transplant. And we were so eagerly awaiting his return to the Formula One paddock. And ultimately, that will never come. Niki, of course, in recent days was best known as a figurehead and non-executive chairman of the Mercedes-AMG Petronas F1 team, and we'll talk about that. But, you know, his story in racing starts with his very humble beginnings, King, because he was not a driver who stood out early on in his career. He spent 1971 and 72, after climbing from Formula 2, he broke in with the March engineering team in 71, moved on to BRM in 1973, and for much of his early career, he seemed a very pedestrian driver, did he not?
Yeah, I would probably say that if you made the assumptions about Niki Lauda before he came to Formula 1, you'd assume that he was just some, you know, rich kid who wanted to drive real fast, wasn't taking this 100% seriously. But if you dug a little deeper, you knew how hard he was trying to be, you know, as good as he could be behind the wheel.
That's true. Lauda had plenty of experience racing. He raced Formula V cars, I guess today's equivalent of a Formula 4 championship. He drove sports cars early on in his career. He moved up to Formula 2 in 71. But, you know, he was a driver who had to buy his way into the sport. But even though he came from a very rich family, he had none of his family support. This family openly disapproved of his racing activities, and that ultimately caused them to feud with them, and, you know, they eventually lost contact. Lauda's first big break came when he took out a 30,000-pound bank loan and secured by a life insurance policy to buy his way into March in 71. And he had to take out quite another substantial loan in 73 as he was moving up to BRM, a team that had, you know, quite a bit of history in the sport, but they were very much a team in decline in 73. They were not by any means a noted powerhouse. Years removed from their last great successes after Graham Hill had moved on. Even though Lauda, he only had a fifth place finish at Belgium to his name as his best result, there was genuine speed there.
Yeah, there was speed there. It was like them acquiring the services of Niki Lauda was a part of this big rebuilding project at Ferrari itself. Because when they signed Niki Lauda, they also signed first as Enzo's assistant, but then the next season he would become team principal himself. Luca di Montezemolo, that's when he came to Ferrari at the same time as Niki Lauda.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And one of the other drivers who was part of BRM's attempt at rebuilding in 73 was a Swiss driver by the name of Clay Regazzoni. And he was brought into Ferrari in 1974 when Ferrari also realized, hey, they had another vacancy left. And Enzo Ferrari asked Clay Regazzoni what he thought of Lauda, and Regazzoni said he spoke so favorably of Lauda that Ferrari promptly signed him, paying enough to clear his debts with his two bank loans. And from there, the fuse was lit, King. When he joined Ferrari, it only took him until his fourth race in Spain, but once he won at the Jarama circuit, things really started to take off from there, didn't it?
Yes, I wouldn't say a total sea change, but it went from Ferrari, you know, fighting just to score points to them, you know, maybe looking at a possible world championship.
Yeah, because, of course, you have to remember the season before, Ferrari didn't even manage so much as a single podium finish. And it's funny, we'll, of course, crack on Ferrari's misfortunes nowadays, but there was a time where making the podium wasn't even a guarantee for Ferrari. And, the dysfunction at that organization was portrayed quite nicely in a very iconic scene from the Ron Howard directed movie Rush, which is, of course, a dramatized retelling of the rivalry between James Hunt and Niki Lauda. And they cover his arrival at Ferrari. And of course, there is the very legendary exchange with Lauda and the Ferrari mechanic. When asked upon his first impressions, Lauda describes it as a shitbox. All of these facilities and you build a piece of crap like this. And that kind of encapsulates the man that Niki Lauda was. He was a no-nonsense, tell-it-as-it-is sort of character, the kind that Formula One fans of a certain age wish there was more of it. He was unfiltered and absolutely uncompromising. He was not just some rich kid doing it as a hobby. He was dedicated and serious to his craft, and that showed when he won two races in 74, finished fourth in the championship, and then he took another massive leap forward in 75 with five victories, including huge, huge victories in Monaco, in Belgium, at the French Grand Prix, and of course with a win in the 75 United States Grand Prix, wrapping up his first championship. And of course, it seemed in 1976 that he would be well on his way to winning another after winning four of his first six races. He had five wins during the season, going up to the 10th round of the season, the critical turning point in Niki Lauda's career.
Yeah, it's almost like his whole life is, you know, after that point, revolved around 1977.
Yes, this would, of course, be the German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring circuit, which, of course, included the infamous Nordschleife section. Lauda was very concerned about the conditions. The Nordschleife, of course, infamous for not necessarily being one of the safest tracks, especially in a time where Formula One was starting to get serious about safety. He attempted to arrange a boycott of the race, but the other drivers voted against it, and by a margin of just one vote, the race went ahead. Now, Lauda was, of course, one of the best drivers at that circuit. It's not that he was, you know, afraid of the track itself. He was afraid of the conditions that would ultimately prove to be a matter of a life or death situation for him. When his car had when something had broken his car, he crashed heavily, and his car caught fire. And only with the assistance of fellow drivers was he extricated from his burning car. He had suffered burns over most of his body. He had suffered multiple fractures. In fact, his condition was so bad that he was administered the last rites in hospital, meaning that there was not a chance that Niki Lauda was going to survive this.
Yeah, and pretty much due to this incident, whether he had survived or not, it became clear that racing on circuits of that length was no longer feasible anymore. That was pretty much one of the reasons why the FIA, you know, introduced a maximum circuit length limit, where, you know, circuits like the Nürburgring Nordschleife could not be used anymore after 1976, where not only is it hard to, you know, manage a circuit of that length, make sure that you have fire and safety personnel, you know, at consistent intervals along the circuit life, but just during the race itself, the weather, where it was raining at the start of the race, but it was dry in some spots, so it was hard to make a tire choice, and, you know, a lot of the teams opted for the quote-unquote faster tire, the slick tires over the treaded wet tires.
Lauda, again, faced a long recovery where, you know, there was talk that he would not survive the crash. And then something amazing happened. He missed only two races in 6 weeks of racing. Through intense recovery after surgery to repair as best as he could some of the scars left behind from the fire at the Nordschleife, Lauda came back just three rounds later at the Italian Grand Prix and finished a respectable fourth place to keep his championship hopes alive for the rest of the season. He bolstered that with a third place at Watkins Glen before it was taken to the final race in monsoon conditions at the inaugural Japanese Grand Prix at Fuji. Lauda, of course, retired, stating that it was just too damn dangerous to drive in those conditions, and ultimately conceded the title to his great friend and rival James Hunt in the process.
Yeah, it's I think it's one of those moments where I wouldn't say it wasn't obvious to fans at the moment. I'd say that's more personal than anything else, where you realize where sometimes it's just too dangerous to race, and no one's ever going to stop you from racing. No one's ever going to call off the race because you personally feel it's too dangerous to race. You just have to make the decision on your own.
Well, no, I agree. That was something that was, in some respects, you could say that was a very brave decision. you know, because drivers weren't, I guess, if I could find a way to say it, you know, racing drivers, they often, especially nowadays, they thought of themselves as gladiators. And Lauda, I guess, had the courage to kind of pull back and realize, you know, you didn't have to race in such conditions. You could pull back and live on to race another day. And ultimately he did, and Lauda was champion again in 1977 with 3 victories, 10 podiums. He'd wrapped up the title after finishing 4th in Watkins Glen. And then with 2 races left to go in the season, and perhaps with a strained relationship at Ferrari, Lauda left and moved on to Brabham, where once again he was a winner. He won races with Brabham in 78, including at Anderstorp with the infamous Brabham BT46 fan car. He won in Anderstorp, he won at Monza, and then he went through the 79 season, had a slump, and then before the Canadian Grand Prix, Lauda called it quits. He was a 2-time world champion. He'd already proven his worth as a driver. He went on to focus on his own business. If he had completely hung it up and never came back to Formula One, I think safe to say Niki Lauda would still be remembered as one of our great champions in the sport.
Yeah, like, what, 2-time world champion? There's, like, pretty much no doubt about it. Like, I think it's easy to say that you have to be one of the sport's greats if you're able to win 2 world championships.
Right. He went on to form his own airline. Niki was an avid fan of aviation, and even to this day, there's an airline that, you know, has been repackaged and rebranded many times, but there is still a Niki Lauda-themed airline. But the racing bug never really left. And for an unprecedented $3 million a year, in 1982, Niki Lauda made one of the most publicized comebacks in Formula One history. And it only took him, it didn't take him long before he refound the magic when he won his 3rd race back in his comeback at Long Beach. He of course went on to finish 5th in that year's championship. But of course he was also directly involved in the driver strike, because 82 was a tumultuous year between the drivers, the constructors, and the sanctioning body, was it not?
Yes, it was. And mainly one of the things that stuck out to Niki about the whole situation when the FIA was trying to introduce the super license was effectively, for those who are familiar with baseball in a way, the FIA wanted to essentially introduced a reserve clause to racing, where the team held your rights, the rights to your contract, for 3 years. You couldn't race for anyone else for 3 years.
Yeah, he was really one that fought for the agency of drivers, as, you know, racing, as, you know, drivers began to become better compensated for the work that they did. Lauda, in the second phase of his career, was still as good as he ever was. 2 wins in 82. A bit of a down year in 83, as McLaren often struggled to qualify for races. In fact, he missed the 1983 Monaco Grand Prix, but out of that qualifying strife, you got some brilliance, like Lauda coming from 23rd on the grid at Long Beach to finish in 2nd. And for those of us IndyCar fans who know, Long Beach is not exactly an easy place to pass, but Lauda gained 21 positions and finished on the podium for one of only 2 podium positions that year. And once McLaren found a partner in TAG Porsche, in 84, Lauda found the championship magic once again. And he did so paired alongside a new young face in Alain Prost, fresh over from the Renault team. McLaren had 2 of the best drivers, an aging, proven veteran champion in Lauda, and an emerging young star of the future in Prost. And although Prost was often many times the quicker of the driver between the two head-to-head, Lauda wouldn't go away in this championship fight.
No. Pretty much any time Lauda could get the car across the line, he was either going to be 1st or 2nd. And it was a contentious season, where if not only did he have to face off against the likes of teammate Alain Prost, but have to hold off Nelson Piquet and Brabham. Yeah, and it came down to a situation where, especially at the, you know, at the start of the turbo era, where a lot of people had unreliable engines, it came down to who can not only get their car across the line first, but who can just get their car across the line, period.
That's true. Lauda started the 84 season retiring from, I'm going to say six out of his first nine races. But afterwards, he went on an incredible tear, a win in Britain, second in Germany, a win in his home race in Austria, the only time that a hometown driver has won the Austrian Grand Prix, second in the Netherlands, a win in Italy, and a fourth place finish at the European Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, the new Nürburgring circuit, yep, Mino, to set up a title-deciding race in Estoril in Portugal. And by the slimmest of margins, just a half a point, with a second place finish behind his teammate Alan Prost, Niki Lauda secured his third championship, putting him in what is still elite company to this day.
Yeah, and pretty much the next year didn't turn out as well. The McLaren wasn't as reliable of a car. Yes, the McLaren pretty much couldn't perform. I think Lauda also ended up in a pretty bad accident during the season, had to miss a race. But that pretty much closed the door on Niki Lauda's Formula One career as a driver.
Of course, he did come back to become in managerial roles. 1993, he was offered a consulting role at Ferrari. 2001, he took on his first team principal role with the Jaguar F1 team, but unfortunately, things just didn't work out. But his greatest role as a F1 executive came when, in September 2012, he joined Mercedes-AMG Petronas F1 team, who again were, at this point, an upper midfield team that won a few races. They had two very good drivers in Nico Rosberg and the now retiring Michael Schumacher, but Lauda was part of a plan that was being put into place to help build the next dynasty of Formula One, and he had a key role in bringing in the most sought-after free agent on the market, Lewis Hamilton, out of McLaren, away from potential destinations like Ferrari and Red Bull, and he brought him to Mercedes. And I can still remember to this day NBC Sports commentator and former driver as well, David Hobbs, saying that this would never work out, that Hamilton was a fool to join Mercedes and leave McLaren, and that Niki Lauda bringing him in would just be the kiss of death to any aspiring program. Well, as it turns out, Lauda ended up being one of the executive figureheads of the new dynasty of the sport. The team made a significant improvement in 2013, and with the start of the hybrid turbo era, thus began one of the greatest runs of dominance ever. Five world championships, likely to be a sixth. The great battles between Hamilton and Rosberg, and later Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas, and Lauda had a tough time, of course, managing when Hamilton and Rosberg were at their feistiest.
Like, kind of stepping back one second, where it wasn't clear about who Mercedes would sign to replace Michael Schumacher, and whether they were replacing Michael Schumacher in the first place, or where Lauda and the executives at Mercedes had to make the decision for Michael himself, because Michael was taking too long to, you know, make the choice to stay or go. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the Mercedes board had a driver in mind to replace a Schumacher. Mercedes were pretty much almost set on having Nico Hülkenberg, while Lauda was convinced that he could get Lewis Hamilton.
That's true, and if not for that doggedness, who knows, we may never, the landscape of Formula One would certainly look much different without Lauda's influence on this team. And of course, he was always a constant presence alongside team principal Toto Wolff. He was as integral to that dynasty as anyone. Of course, he had to take time off after a lung transplant in August of 2018, and we were hoping to see him back in ultimately will never come to be. You know, we mentioned as well that Lauda was heavily involved in aviation. One of his planes had a disastrous crash, and in fact, Lauda's involvement in the investigation of Lauda Air 004 actually led to Boeing changing the design of the thrust reversers on the 767 and catching a flaw that they might not have otherwise spotted.
Saying that they might not have otherwise spotted is kind of very generous on Boeing's part, or Boeing tried to blame the incident on the airline and pilot error, and Lauda volunteered that he would get in a Boeing 767-300 and try to recreate the same conditions and try to save the plane, and Boeing pretty much had to admit that they wouldn't let Niki Lauda do that because Boeing felt that it was irrecoverable.
Yes, so Lauda as a man, of course, had been through it all. He lived an amazing life as a driver, as an executive, as a businessman, and as a hero of our sport, really. King, what is the one thing you'll take away most from the legacy that Niki Lauda leaves behind?
The most I'll take away that, I don't know, it feels like the most to take away from Niki Lauda is that racing skill isn't natural, that it's a learned skill, and if you try hard enough and if you dedicate yourself hard enough, you can be the best in the sport.
That's true, and I think a lot of people will remember his perseverance in one of the greatest comebacks in sporting history. And we, of course, come from a sport where, you know, we, of course, a more contemporary example, Alex Zanardi's comeback from losing both legs in a crash to continue an excellent motorsport career and become an Olympian. Lauda stared death in the face at the Nürburgring in 1976. He was a burned and broken man, and, you know, it was often... Yeah, that's true. Robert Kubica as well. Billy Monger, recent winner of the PAL Grand Prix. More contemporary examples. Lauda should not have survived that crash. And 6 weeks later, he was back in a car. You would never, ever see anything like this again. No one would put themselves through that. Nobody would need to put themselves through that, but Niki Lauda had a point to prove. He wanted to win a championship, and he was willing to do anything that he could to win it. So he came back, arguably, well before he was even ready, and finished out the remainder of the season from Italy onward. It was one of the great stories in all of motorsport, and, you know, I'm glad that if you haven't already seen the movie Rush, a movie that has genuinely got some of my best friends into motor racing just from watching it. It's a larger than life story that, you know, yes, some of it is dramatized, but most of the story is real. And, you know, Niki Lauda's story is one of the all time greats.
Yeah, where it's like, I'd highly recommend watching Rush. It isn't 100% accurate, but I'd say it's 100% authentic.
Absolutely. It encapsulated everything that was Niki Lauda as a driver and as a person, really. There were many, many tributes in Monaco from drivers like Lewis Hamilton and Sebastian Vettel wearing special helmet designs to honor the late three-time champion. From the pre-race and post-race ceremonies where drivers wore signature red caps with Niki on the front of them. You know, it's kind of funny. One of our friends of the show, Patrick, said that Niki Lauda nowadays is the only white dude wearing a red cap with white text that you can trust nowadays. as bitter and as cynical as it sounds, it was very much true. Lauda wasn't going to bullshit you. Lauda was going to give you everything as a driver and tell you exactly what it's thought as a person. And I think our sport and our world is going to miss a driver like that. So Godspeed, Niki. You live one awesome life, and we celebrate that fondly. After this break, we'll be back to discuss the Monaco Grand Prix. So, we made it to Monaco. The first act, I guess the warm-up act of Day of Classics 4. Your pre-game for the Indianapolis 500. And nothing fits the pre-game atmosphere like having Cleveland Browns star Odell Beckham Jr., which is crazy enough to say as it sounds, because in Monte Carlo, it's the only place where you won't be criticized for spending a weekend on a boat.
And man, there's so many ways that Cleveland is different than Monte Carlo. I'd never assume that a Cleveland Brown would be at the Monaco Grand Prix.
That's true. You know, with Tom Brady last year, obviously the next great step is to get one of the top stars from the Cleveland Browns, perennial doormats of the NFL. We went in this race thinking that there was going to be an expected outcome. And sure enough, and especially with a lot more emotion attached to it, Lewis Hamilton did take pole position, and Lewis Hamilton did go on to win the race. Hamilton pretty much led convincingly for the whole shot. It'll take only one pit stop, and even though he was driving on badly blistered medium tires, and, you know, he himself over the radio was, you know, Monaco's a long race. We mentioned in 194 that it's gotten shorter for television's sake, but it's still a grueling race for these drivers, and Hamilton felt like he didn't have enough in his tires to go the distance, but eventually he did, by way of backing up the field mostly. A commanding drive, maybe not the greatest of his career, though, I think it's fair to say.
I wouldn't say the greatest of his career. I'd say it was definitely a hard-fought win, where it's
it was a hard-fought win. He had consistent pressure from Max Verstappen and the Red Bull Honda, who almost split the two Mercedes of Lewis Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas from Turn 1 out of Santa Fe, ultimately settled in behind Valtteri Bottas, but as we would come to find out, the race would take a sudden turn during the middle of the first safety car intervention.
Yes, it took a wild turn, where Mercedes decided for their pit strategy they were just going to double stack their cars. They asked Bottas to purposely drop back during the virtual safety car so they'd have enough time to double stack. They wouldn't be literally one behind the other. But Bottas dropping back left a gap that Red Bull thought that it could use to their advantage, where they were just stopping Verstappen. Let's see how this works out. They release Verstappen. Verstappen is ahead of Bottas, but not ahead by a full car length. He isn't clear of Bottas.
No, they make contact, and that contact ultimately gives Bottas a slow puncture where he'd have to pit a second time and concede second place on the road. For that, Max Verstappen would pick up a 5-second time penalty that, as he was chasing down Lewis Hamilton in the closing laps, you'd have to feel like, yeah, even if he gets around him, he's still not going to win the race. You know, so it's a brilliant effort, but ultimately, with that 5-second time penalty looming, it's not going to mount for much, is it not?
And then something else that we learned after the race, Verstappen botched a critical setting change during his pit stop, where he went to, you know, low torque mode to easily launch out of his pit box and pit lane, but forgot to turn it back up when he left pit lane, meaning that he essentially had no low speed power. So he effectively handicapped his own car. He had essentially turbo lag.
Oh goodness. And you know, I was watching Verstappen try and chase down, and it's clear that its car was hooked up through the corners, but, you know, let's say as they come out of the bottom of Mirko through the tunnel and into the Novel Chicane, it just looked like the Mercedes could always pull away in what short straights there were. And, you know, certainly having the car not optimized for the conditions, that didn't help.
No, doesn't help at all, where it, during the race, watching it live, you felt there was tension behind Lewis Hamilton, that, you know, Hamilton's tires were spent, and you could clearly tell that, but it didn't add up to the other side of things, where it's like, how can Max Verstappen not be able to keep up with Lewis off of the straights? It can't be just simply a power unit advantage. Something was clearly not right completely. And I wouldn't say that, you know, Red Bull botched a chance at a win, because for other reasons, like, I don't think Verstappen would have been able to pull, you know, a 5-second gap, but they had a chance, and effectively, due to literally driver error, it got thrown away.
Yeah, and Verstappen made one last valiant lunge at the no-avail chicane, with just a couple of laps to go. I believe this was three laps to go. The two of them made slight contact under braking. They both carry on, and that effectively ended any chance of Max Verstappen had of getting around Hamilton on track. And that was the climax of the action. You know, there were Verstappen was lining up for a move that seemed like it would never come. As I described it, it was like one long, drawn-out foreplay session where eventually nobody really wants to do anything because they're not in the mood for it.
Yeah, and it wasn't just out front. It felt like that throughout the whole field, except for one Ferrari driver.
Oh, my goodness. So to tell the story of how Charles Leclerc ended up where he was at, we have to go back to Q1 on Saturday. You know, typically, you know, if the race at Monaco is not going to be fun, you know, at least qualifying, you know, you're going to get a good show because it's the tightest track. It's the most demanding track, and time trials or qualifying, it's always a good spectacle. But safe to say that Ferrari may have boxed themselves into a corner just a bit.
Yes, they boxed themselves into a corner where in Q1, it clearly you could tell that they were planning on having two runs for each of their drivers, where you have, you know, your banker lap, and then you're going to go for it for your second run. For Charles, on the other hand, that he pushed the margins to the limit, to the point where they couldn't send him out for a second run.
Yeah, he had messed up on both of his qualifying attempts, and then, of course, there was the incident where he was summoned to the weighbridge and, you know, missed it, and was boxed, and, you know, Ferrari thought they had enough time to send him back out, you know, that they didn't have to send him back out, I should say. He would be safe to go in, and then you found himself where both Leclerc and Vettel were at risk of getting bumped in Q1, on a track that is notoriously difficult to pass on. Vettel does save his skin and get his way into Q2 with a flying lap, but Leclerc is still in the garage and has no time to get back into the fray, and he is eliminated after Q1 and has to start and qualify 16th. I believe he eventually moves up to 15 due to penalties, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, due to penalties. Mm-hmm. But it was... Their tactics were highly questionable. Like,
yeah.
For one hand, pretty much.
I know it's perplexing, and I wish we had Dre on here because I know he would have some choice words for this strategy, and so did everybody else for that matter. When friend of the podcast Stuart Chabert Taylor is out here making parody videos, telling Ferrari how to do their own job with 1980s graphics and the full works, you know that you have messed up very, very badly. And this ironically coming after shortly after they did a presentation on winning strategy. Oh. How strategy is important to success.
Though, like, the only reason I could come up with why Ferrari didn't want to send out Leclerc again is that they thought the first time was fast enough, and they didn't want to spend the extra set of tires to send him out again, because that's literally the only cost to them sending him out again, that they would have to use up another set of tires.
I think it would have been worth it. I think it honestly would have been worth it, but instead you put your driver behind an eight ball. And let's not forget, this is his home race.
Yep.
Yeah. First drive with Ferrari at his home race, a race where he had struggled in Formula 2 and struggled at last year. carrying dual tributes on his helmet, one to his late father Hervé, the other to his late godfather Jules Bianchi. So there was a lot of optimism going into this race, and we're thinking this is the weekend where destiny should tell us that if Charles Leclerc is going to win his first race, it's going to come here. Even though the Ferrari is not optimized for a track like this with its number of slow and medium speed corners and how the Ferrari is, let's just say, not compliant through them. And this had come right after Sebastian Vettel had bended at Sandevad in final practice, and he was lucky to be able to get a qualifying run at all, let alone get into Q3 and qualify on the second row. But no, that puts Charles Leclerc in a position where he is starting from 15th, and he's going to get the most out of his money because he's picking off midfielders, a brilliant pass on Lando Norris at the hairpin formerly known as Lowe's. He sends it up the inside of Romain Grosjean at La Race Casse, which is a tricky place to pass, but he has such confidence that he feels, all right, I can do this again. Let's try this on Nico Hülkenberg. But Hülkenberg slams the door on him coming out, and that causes Leclerc to collide with the barriers, do a quarter spin, and then that damage inflicts a puncture on his car that just shreds up his right rear tire, and, you know, that ultimately ends his race. He would retire after 16 laps. He was the only retirement in this Monaco Grand Prix. But there's no doubt about it. Leclerc should not have even been starting that far back to begin with.
Yeah, it was... I don't know. Leclerc shouldn't have been in that position. But he also should not have been that aggressive out in track, where there were, you know, one or two complaints in the press conference, like in the press pen, about Leclerc from other drivers. But, like, it's partly understandable, but also you can't be that aggressive.
Yeah, and it seems like here again is a driver who is trying so desperately hard to impress his new team and to prove that he is worth every bit that Ferrari have invested into him. He has world championship potential, but especially early in the stage in the season, you know, he's driving a bit too hard to try and impress. And, you know, he's still a young kid. He turns only 22 this year, so he's got time to develop. And I stress this to everybody, especially the Leclerc fans who are listening to this, because I believe highly in the talents of Charles Leclerc, but you've got to be patient with him. You've got to give him time, because let's not forget, Lewis Hamilton didn't win his first race with Leclerc when he debuted. Jacques Villeneuve didn't win his first race with Williams when he debuted. You know, Michael Schumacher didn't win his first race with Benetton when he first showed up. You gotta give him time, and he'll learn with time. He knows that, you know, qualifying, you know, yes, he shouldn't have been put out there in strategy, but, you know, hey, if he didn't mess up his first banker lap, maybe he wouldn't be in a spot where he'd desperately be needing to try and put in a second.
And then we already have the Italian rag sheets trying to stir the pot, where they are claiming that Leclerc and people associated with Leclerc are putting out feelers to other teams.
For what? There's no other team that'll take him, that'll give him the equipment that he needs to succeed. I know Ferrari's dysfunctional, but where else are you going to go and have the same success?
Yeah, it's like, it'd only be Mercedes. That's the only place where he could go and not be in a worse position.
And I don't know if you know this, but spoilers, Valtteri Bottas' job is no longer at risk, barring an absolute catastrophe late in the season. But yes, Charles Leclerc, your only retirement of the race. In the end, Lewis Hamilton takes win number 77 of his career. This now puts him 14 back of Michael Schumacher's once untouchable record in his 85th pole position, which makes me think by the time he hangs it up, Lewis Hamilton will get to 100 pole positions. Perfect weekend, no complaints whatsoever. Max Verstappen did finish fourth on the road, did win driver of the day. He was second, but eventually demoted to fourth because of his time penalty. So that meant that Sebastian Vettel, out of all this, despite the crash of Friday practice, despite a car that was not compliant for, not suited for this track, somehow goes on to break the 1-2 streak of Mercedes by just a half a second over Valtteri Bottas, who, again, his race was effectively compromised from the moment he had to pit a second time for his slow puncture.
Yes, and I do love how Sebastian said, quote, I sort of tumbled into second place.
He knows that if on paper he probably shouldn't have finished this high up, but you know, it was, you know, I don't think he's complaining about that result. Of course, we got the great photo that we're using as our podcast cover of Hamilton and Vettel, with each with their own Nikki tribute helmets, embracing and shaking hands apart from me, which was really, really awesome to see. Perhaps the start of a turnaround for Sebastian Vettel, even as some are reporting that he might be considering hanging up, which I don't believe that either. It's the same with the Leclerc, the rags that are stirring up. I don't see it happening. Nothing would surprise me, but again, I just don't see it yet.
Yeah, I don't see it either. There's like maybe like that slim chance that he could retire from Formula One, try something else, but I don't. Very slim.
Yeah. Yeah, I think ultimately he does want that one more title with Ferrari before he hangs it up. It's just got to start coming together soon. And if not now, then when? With Max Verstappen being devoted to fourth, Pierre Gasly, now, he was not in the lead fight, but he looked a much more confident driver. He got the bonus point for the fastest lap because it was still far ahead of the rest of the field that Red Bull could afford to pit him a second time and not have him lose any track position. Another good race for Pierre. Again, still a little bit behind Max Verstappen, but again, it's Max Verstappen, arguably the form of his life. I would say that, you know, this race was probably the first sign of, you know, the bad habits of the old Max Verstappen. But again, that unsafe release wasn't all entirely his fault. He was just given the signal to go, and he went. Speaking of Formula 1.5, how about Carlos Sainz? On a weekend where we all lamented the struggles of a Spaniard at McLaren, well, at least one Spaniard in another McLaren had salvaged a little bit of dignity from the boys at Woking, thanks to a brilliant double overtake on the first lap, gets past Alex Albon coming out of Sandoval, and then swoops around the outside at Casino Square around Danica Villa to take sixth place, joint best result for McLaren this season, and his best finish since joining Renault earlier this season. King, are you starting to feel like maybe the Carlos Sainz of old, the Carlos Sainz that we voted Driver of the Year, is he starting to make a comeback?
Oh, I think he never went away. I think it was the Renault that was just bad.
Oh, and we'll talk about that in a second. But along with Carlos Sainz, a team that had an impressive weekend from start to finish: Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda, Danny Kvyat in seventh, Alex Albon in eighth. Fantastic performance from Toro Rosso this weekend. They were pretty much top 10 all weekend long.
Ooh, yeah, it's the Toro Rosso looks very good this year. Very good this year.
And should I point out, this is Kvyat's best result since being dropped from Red Bull to Toro Rosso early in 2016. For Albon, that's his best career result. And you feel like that's only going to improve for there if Toro Rosso get more chances to see like this. Also, all four Honda powered cars on the grid inside the top eight. So McLaren gets to succeed without Honda, and Honda gets to succeed with Red Bull and Toro Rosso. Now, of course, speaking of Renault, again, Nico Hülkenberg did effectively become Formula 1.5 champion, but not necessarily their best day when reigning and defending Monaco Grand Prix winner Daniel Ricciardo has to scrap to finish ninth. Oh, boy, that bet's looking really safe, King. I just got to say.
And I forgot, I think it was the Sky F1 feature where they were discussing Renault and how they describe Renault as going through growing pains, how they're, you know, expanding facilities. They broke ground on a new facility at Viry for the power unit side of the team. They have all these new employees at Enstone, and they feel like they're going through growing pains where because of, you know, trying to integrate everyone into the organization, a lot of things are falling through the cracks. Upgrades are being developed, but not actually making it to the car.
Yeah, and for a team that's investing that much into their F1 program, you just got to feel like that's not satisfactory. Ricciardo had actually finished 10th on the road, but because Romain Grosjean picked up a 5-second time penalty for cutting the pit exit line, that puts Ricciardo in 9th and Grosjean in the final points-paying position in 10th. They were among the last of the lead lap cars. The last was Lando Norris in 11th, just outside of the points by 5 seconds. As we go through the rest of the finishers, Sergio Perez had a massive Code Brown moment during the safety car, did he not?
Oh, man. Like, first I saw the picture, then I saw the video.
And then you saw the alternate angle of him almost striking down two marshals coming out of the blind pit exit during the safety car. The marshals were there picking up debris on the track. Perez just didn't see them coming, and he was very lucky it didn't end in tragedy.
Yeah, luckily enough, there was a car-shaped gap between the two marshals.
Oh, goodness, yes. Goodness, that was a close call there, and I'm glad that everybody came out of that all right. And I'm not here to apportion blame on that. I'm just glad that everybody got through it safely. We mentioned the other Renault, Nico Hülkenberg, 13th, a pretty pedestrian day for Renault. Kevin Magnussen was a surprise. He qualified 6th, started 5th, but slumped down to 14th in the end. Just was nowhere, really, this race. A bit of a disappointment after Haas seemingly made steps forward in Spain. I'll tell you one driver who did a fantastic job. I know it's only 15th, but bravo to George Russell. You're not the last place car on the track.
Yeah, kept his nose clean, took positions where he could, and guess what? He finished 15th.
Yeah, Robert Kubica finishing 18th. And I'll say that's a massive accomplishment because in the months and the years leading up to his comeback, what was always going to be the track that would give Robert Kubica trouble with the limited range of motion in his right arm? It was going to be Monaco, where you have to go full lock through Lowe's hairpin. But no, he finished the race. He was not the last finisher. That would unfortunately go down to Antonio Giovinazzi in 19th and finished 2 laps down and was penalized 10 seconds for causing a massive traffic jam at Laras Cass. Goodness gracious, Alfa Romeo, what the hell happened to you? You look quick in practice and then all of a sudden it just goes terribly. And especially on Kimi Raikkonen in the weekend of his 300th Grand Prix.
Man, it's hard weekend for Alfa, but their recent slump continues.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, and especially when it wasn't until wasn't that long ago when we were in preseason, we were talking about Alpha potentially being able to leapfrog the likes of Renault and McLaren and Haas and be the force of the midfield, and that's two tough races in a row for them where they just really haven't gotten it together. I should also mention as well Lance Stroll in 16th, but you know, peak kind of got in the way of Valtteri Bottas just a little bit. I don't know what was happening there. And Lance, you're better than this. Antonio, you're better than this as well. What are you doing, lads? As mentioned, Charles Leclerc was the only retirement after 16 laps due to floor damage. Fastest lap went to Pierre Gasly on lap 72 on his final run. So the Monaco Grand Prix. You grade this on the curve, King?
Ooh, for Monaco's, it was okay. In terms of general F1 races, could do a lot better. So I'd say overall, in terms of season grades, maybe 4 or 5 out of 10. It wasn't terrible, but like it could be better.
Dre made a good point during our Day of Classics 4 hangout that the race was fine by Monaco standards, but because of the time penalty to Max Verstappen, it has no rewatch value. This is one of those just watch the highlights to get the gist of it kind of races. There's not really that much you would gain out of watching this from start to finish.
I'd probably say it's a good entry point into F1 in a sort of a bad way. You get a general picture of how the season is going for all the teams.
Yeah, that's very true, I suppose. And again, it just, you know, it feels like we have this discussion every year about whether or not F1 has outgrown Monaco, and it breaks my heart because Monaco's a really pretty track. It's a race with a lot of history. It means a lot to the teams and the drivers to win this race. They want to win this race, But nobody really wants to get up for this race.
No.
It means a lot to the elite spectators. It means a lot to the drivers, but it doesn't really resonate with the fans as much as it used to. And that's sad.
I know it's a very IndyCar thing, and F3 is actually experimenting with it this year. But maybe F1 could consider having not a completely different technical regulation rule set for each of the races, but try to, you know, classify the races differently so that there's a specific rule set to make the racing better at certain tracks.
You know, funny thing, we'll talk about a different rule set of cars here competing around Monaco soon. Grading on a curve, I give it about a 6 Tesla Hyperlite ads out of 10. So as we go into our championship standings, starting with the drivers, and again with 4 wins in the first 6 races, Lewis Hamilton has built up a 17-point cushion at 137 points over his Mercedes teammate Valtteri Bottas on 120. In third, Sebastian Vettel on 82 points. He has jumped ahead of Max Verstappen, fourth place at 78 points. Charles Leclerc slumps down to fifth. He's at 57 points, ahead of Pierre Gasly on 32 points. He is sixth. Best of the midfield, Carlos Sainz jumping all the way up to seventh for McLaren Renault. He is on 18 points, 4 points ahead of Kevin Magnussen in eighth on 14. It's a two-way tie for ninth between Sergio Perez, a Racing Point, and Kimi Raikkonen of Alfa Romeo on 13 points. Lando Norris on 12, Daniel Kvyat in 9. Daniel Ricciardo on 8, Alex Albon on 7, Nico Hülkenberg on 6, Lance Stroll on 4, Romain Grosjean 2, Giovinazzi, Russell, and Kubica, the only non-scorers this season. To the Constructors' Championship we go. Stop me if you've heard this before. Mercedes have an almost unassailable lead in the Constructors' Championship. They're on 257 to Ferrari's 139 in second place. Oh, man. Oh, how we long for the days where Ferrari looked like they had the weapon to challenge Mercedes, you know, before they had to fundamentally redesign the suspension of the front of the car. In fact, they're doing so below par that Red Bull Racing Honda are within just 29 points. They're at 110 in third place. And the standout of the midfield, McLaren Renault on 30 points with a 13-point cushion to Racing Point in fifth on 17 points. And this is where it really starts to heat up, because then you have Haas on 16, Toro Rosso on 16, Renault on 14, Alfa Romeo on 13, and all the way down at the bottom, there's Williams still at 0 points.
I'd say the two points that Renault got today really helped. They're no longer ninth. Now Alpha's ninth. But it really feels McLaren has kind of run away with the 1.5 Constructors title.
Yeah, and especially at this stage, because this is where things started to fall off for McLaren, as we realized that their early season form last year just was not sustainable. And you know, if you're a McLaren fan, you have to hope that it's going to turn around and they're going to be able to keep this momentum moving forward, because that's only going to set them up for bigger and better things down the road. So next time we are going to see Formula One will be at the Canadian Grand Prix in Charlie's homeland in Montreal at the Circuit Gilles Villeneuve. This is a race where you feel like, you know, if Ferrari have a high speed bullet, this might be the track to get their season back on form, because Montreal is a high-speed track, and it's going to be punishing on brake. And the only thing that worries me is that Montreal was long straights and a lot of low-speed corners. How do you see this one turning out?
Ooh, I'm more worried about the high-speed corners at Montreal, to be honest. I think that's probably going to be Ferrari's Achilles heel, where it's like, they might be able to keep up in a straight line, but anytime you have to go through a high-speed chicane, it's not going to be good.
Oh, yes, that is that's definitely true. And if you look just at the recent form of this race, Vettel won last year, Hamilton won it the 3 years prior, Ricciardo won in 2014, so there's hope for Red Bull Honda at least. That ought to be interesting to see how that plays out. Let's take a bit of time to reset here, and we'll get into Formula 2 in Monaco, because, whoo boy, there was some interesting stuff that happened that week.
F2 at Monaco. Man, just the feature race. What happened? What happened?
Apparently half the field lost a lap and a red flag, and nobody could find a way to fix it because there was no way to fix it.
Yeah, there's no way in the rule book for you to just give half the field a lap back.
No, and this all was triggered when Mick Schumacher had run into Tatiana Calderon at La Rascasse and caused a traffic jam that brought out a red flag, and more than half the field was accidentally scored a lap down as a result. Mick Schumacher, for his part, received a, I believe it was a drive-through penalty for causing an avoidable collision?
Yes.
Yeah, and that was coming at a point where, of course, Mick Schumacher was found at fault for a wreck that would have put him in prime position to win the race had he not been penalized because he was first among the runners who had already stopped for tires.
Oh, and a lot of people were not happy with the stewarding that race, including his team Prima, where pretty much they felt like the mandatory tire change, where they made a protest to the FIA, and FIA said, race direction's right, we're moving on with our lives.
Yeah, it's the strangest thing, but, you know, in a familiar theme, the pole sitter ended up winning the race. As Nick, they call him DeVries, took the victory and ate up a huge chunk of Nicholas Latifi's points lead, as Latifi would only go on to finish in 12th position. This is a big points day for the Dutchman, who, again, had just recently been sacked from McLaren's driver development program after being there for what seemed like 37 years.
Yeah, it was good weekend on the whole for DeVries, where it's looking like he's going to be one of the contenders for the championship, especially considering what happened to his title rival, the current points leader, Nicholas Latifi, in Monaco.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to catch a lot of this, but apparently Latifi was driving with a little bit of extra vigor, if you will, and not making a lot of friends out on the track.
He's not making friends with anyone. A lot of wheel-to-wheel, I wouldn't say, there was some contact, but a lot of it was like the kind of what we criticized Leclerc for being too aggressive.
Yeah, something like that, yes, yeah. I could definitely see that. Also, it looked like it was going to be a great day for Luca Giotto's title bid until he was disqualified for the feature race for his car using rack stops of a thickness that did not comply with the sporting regulations.
Man, that's something you don't see often.
So again, I'm kind of an idiot when it comes to the engineering parts of the car. What's the rack stop do on this thing?
I assume... Oh, God. Rack stop. I assume that is what stops the... it's basically what causes the steering lock.
If you were about to say it stops the rack.
It stops the rack.
Oh my god. Yeah, that was... So that got a DSQ, and that promoted Nobuhara Matsushita to second in the feature race, out of Sergio Sete Câmara for Dams rounding out the podium in third, out of Dorian Boccalacci in fourth, and Guan Yu Zhao, last of the lead lap runners, in fifth. And somehow, they had no idea how to fix this. Artem Markelov, on his Formula 2 return, finished in sixth. Luis de la Traz in seventh and taking eighth and the sprint race pole, Antoine Huber, because that becomes important as we get into Saturday's sprint race. Oh, baby. Why can't Monaco this be this fun this often?
Yeah, why can't Monaco have, you know, a situation where three cars could win the race on the last lap?
It looked like a redux of the Freedom 100, because at the end you had Antoine Huber, who was effectively leading the slides to flag, but Luis de la Traz was gaining on him, and Guan Yu Zhao at the end was putting on a charge for a podium place, and he could have found himself in contention for the win if Huber or de la Traz made a mistake. So King, take us through this incredible finish, which thankfully Formula One have put the finish of this one up on their YouTube channel, so you can watch it anytime. It's worth it.
Yeah, so where the video pretty much starts is at final lap Poitiers, where it seems like, you know, on paper, your leader, your current leader, is Antoine Hubert, followed up by Louis Delatraz in the Carlin, right behind him. And it seems like if it's now time more than ever, that's now. But also lurking behind them in third is Guanyu Zhao. And pretty much Johnny Herbert mentions that, you know, if any of them make a mistake here, Zhao could get second, maybe even first.
Yeah.
So they run down the Nouvelle Chicane. Delatraz gets a run, but not even, you know, a good enough run to make a lunch, but he's right on his gearbox. They go around to back, same thing holds. Swimming pool, same thing holds. Then they go around Rascass, and Hubert's back steps out just a little bit, but just enough that Delatraz can make a run. So they go around Anthony Nogues, Delatraz is there, DRS open. Delatraz looks around the left side, they go side by side, and then they cross the line. And if it wasn't for timing and scoring, I probably wouldn't have known who won immediately from the camera angle.
59/1,000th of a second.
It was so close. So close.
It was a damn good race, and I thought Delatraz would have had him. He almost pulled an Oliver Askew to Antoine Hubert's Ryan Norman. But Hubert held on and becomes the first rookie to win a race this season. A great performance from Antoine Hubert, one that puts him now solidly into the top 10 in the championship. And I'll tell you what, just ahead of him in fifth place, as we'll run down the full championship order, is it safe to say that Guanyu Zhao has been the surprise revelation of the rookie class between himself, Hubert, let's say Correa, Schumacher, Calderon, and one other driver we'll talk about here?
Yeah, I'd definitely say he's the breakout driver when you consider, you know, expectations going in and then the actual results.
Very low expectations going in. Again, he's the only driver from mainland China in the field. Only won a single race in the now-defunct European F3 Championship. But he's coming alive under Univirtuosi Racing. Let's go into this championship standings, because with De Vries finishing 7th in the sprint after winning the feature, he is now within 1 point of Nicholas Latifi, who finished 12th in the feature and 10th in the sprint, which was not a point-scoring result. Double non-scoring result, DSQ, and a retirement from Luca Giotto now puts him well behind on 67 points. Jack Aitken, another double non-scoring result. He's still 4th at 62 points. Guanyu Zhao in 5th, the top rookie at 54 points. Sergio Sate Cameron sits at 52. Antoine Hubert jumps up to 7th on 46 points. Louis Delatraz in 8th on 34 points. Dorian Boccolacci, very solid weekend for the young Frenchman. 4th in the feature, 5th in the sprint, and he now moves up to 9th on 30 points, with Nobuhiro Matsushita 10th on 26 points. He is tied with Jordan King, who, of course, was off doing something else in the Midwestern United States. I'm called the Indianapolis 500.
I don't know. Was that worth missing for this?
I don't know. I mean, again, we're glad that Chris Mina is recovering well from surgery. Again, that you couldn't put that on Jordan, but, you know, King has said it was technically possible that he could have done it because the races are all on Friday and Saturday and the Indy 500 Sunday.
Yes, technically it would have been possible. But you would have had to miss, you know, carb day practice. Maybe he had, you know, requirements from his sponsor.
Yeah, and of course, if you believe the tall tales that were warned that NASCAR and ISC are trying to leverage the Indy 500 to move to Saturday, which, oh, real you're funny. Serious. Let me laugh even harder. Also, alarm bell should be ringing. I know it's early in the season, and I know Mick wasn't a fast starter when he got to Formula 3, but he's 15th in the championship on 14 points, tied with Callum Ilott.
Yeah, literally, Markelov showed up for one weekend, and he's already 13th in the championship.
With two more points than Mick Schumacher. I want to believe he'll get it turned around, but it's got to start soon. Let's talk about Mahavir Raghunathan, shall we? Because I believe the best is yet to come. because it certainly can't get worse than his weekend in Monaco, where in his group of qualifying, he was 5 seconds off the fastest man in his group, Callum Aylott, and would have missed and was more than 107% slower than the pole time set in Group B in the session. And somehow it managed to get worse.
It managed to get worse. He thought he was in Charlotte.
Oh my goodness. If you have not yet seen the long montage of him holding up Jack Aitken throughout most of the race, this is a driver who, again, has never had a race on street circuits before, and certainly not at this high level of competition, and it showed. There were multiple opportunities where Ragunathan could have made way for Aitken, and he didn't. That was arguably the most blatant a screw job that a British driver had received at Monaco at the hands of an orange car by a mediocre Pye driver since David Coulthard was held up behind Enrique Bernaldi in 2001.
God, but not only did he hold up Aitken, he ended Aitken's race.
Oh my gosh, yes, a 20-second time penalty for an avoidable collision with Aitken. Oh my goodness, how did Aitken react to this? That's what I want to know.
Let me see if I can pull up. Because
he was blocking like a F1 video game player. And of course, this should be a good time to remind you that Mahavir Ragunathan has a website, and you can email for sponsorship inquiries, and you can also donate to become a personal sponsor of his journey, as he is ranked 17th in India per driverdb.com.
Ooh, and I can't find any quotes from Jack Aitken from the race weekend.
I would honestly, I don't know, man. I would have been furious with him. I would have been ready to throw hands. You know, I made this point over the weekend, and I didn't get to catch much of the races. But think back to some earlier Formula 2 / GP2 punching bags we had. You know, you think of your Rodolfo Gonzalez's, your Johnny Chicado Jr.'s, your Sergio Canamassas, even your Sean Galeos, and you think, they all look like Senna in their prime compared to Ragunathan, who, again, comes in with very little high-level experience. Yes, he has driven a Toro Rosso F1 car in a glorified track day campaign and become a champion that by being the only driver that showed up for every race, but it's clear that he's a liability in F2. I'm going to come out and say it, and if Formula 1 can take away Yuji Ide super license, a driver who's won races at high levels in GT500 and Formula Nippon, it could certainly, you know, at least take the time to examine if Ragunathan is F2 caliber. And honestly, I don't think that's a long debate.
Yeah, it's his CV certainly doesn't say that he was prepared for this.
It'd be one thing if he was slow, but dangerous is another matter. He's slow, both slow and dangerous. You know, I'll come out and say it. I would much rather have Carmen Yorta in my car in her prime than Ragunathan.
Not gonna lie, that's true.
Oh my goodness, that's I fear that's only going to get worse than it's going to get better. And at least now that they're coming back to permanent road courses, maybe it'll start to show some form. But if he has a repeat like that at Paul Ricard or Red Bull Ring, I'm taking his license away. And MP Racing's just got to find a new driver. I don't care how much money he brings.
Yeah, you just got to find a new driver. Just don't run that car.
Oh, my boy. Oh, and we almost forgot the sprint race start where he PlayStation San Devat and gain 8 places.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, that is a video game move.
It's a video game move.
Y'all just given up on life so much that you just shortcut the entire corner? I mean, maybe we're overthinking. As much as we're trashing him, you know, he did manage to overtake 8 cars in one corner in Monaco. I know it doesn't count. Okay, enough of that misery. Let's get into the Berlin E-Prix. Let's go to the airport. And in one of the biggest wins for the private sector we've had, Lucas Degrassi took the lead 7 minutes in and did not look back.
Yeah, this was the Lucas Degrassi of season 2. Like, this is the Lucas Degrassi that could not be stopped for anything.
And in qualifying, we got a glimpse of the Sebastian Buemi that could not be stopped for anything as he took his first pull since Renault EDAMS became Nissan EDAMS, and he started on the front row alongside Stoffel Vandoorne? On the front row? How could this be?
How could this be? When you thought that we were going to see, like, hey, remember Gen 1? I remember Gen 1. Stoffel's like, yeah, I remember Gen 1 too. I was in Formula 1.
He had such high hopes. But it didn't take long for Lucas Degrassi to make his way up from third on the grid. He quickly picked off Vandoorne, and he quickly picked off Wemmy, took the lead with 38 minutes left in the race, and never really looked threatened at any point during the race. It was a 1.8 second margin of victory over Sebastian Wemmy, so you're starting to get a feeling of an air of familiarity. No, this one too, it feels comfortable. It feels like you've been to this home before.
Yeah, it feels like the cream is, you know, finally rising to the top.
So congratulations, people who hated the early season chaos because you don't like to have fun. You're getting exactly what you want. You're welcome.
Welcome. You're getting the traditional title fight between Lucas Degrassi, Jean-Eric Verne, and Wemmy's back too, so
yeah, Wemmy with his with a second place finish. This, of course, would be his. This is his best result since Marrakesh in 2018. That has been a long time between a second place finish. In fact, this is first podium since Mexico City last season. No, excuse me, New York City last season. Wow. My apologies. Yeah, it's been a long time coming since we've seen Wemmy in a pole position again. This was a driver who, throughout 2015 to 2017, he looked unbeatable.
Yep. I mean,
How much psychological damage did Montreal do to him?
Oh, Lord. I would say the fall of Renault and the rise of Nissan has been a very, very long one for EDAMS.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Oliver Rowland, it's clear that the car has speed. Wemmy's been on pole, Rowland's been on pole, but they're clearly missing opportunities there. I have a feeling he's going to win one of these next three, but if he has any outside shot of winning the title, he's got to start racking up victories in a hurry.
Like now, there are only three races left.
And Jean-Eric Verne had a pretty good day. He started eighth, but quietly and comfortably picked his way through the field to finish in third again. So another familiar podium. Degrassi first, Wemmy second, Verne in third.
Yep. But man, Jean-Eric Verne showed why this track is great today, especially where they put the attack mode activation zone. Jev took full use of that. Like, you know, we're at the massive airport apron at Tempelhof, so the corners are real swung out wide. It's like Cleveland. It's like a European version of the old Cleveland circuit.
Yes, Burke Lakefront Airport.
Yeah, so they have the attack mode on the outside, and pretty much, if you went through the attack, if you got attack mode, you're pretty much activating it instantaneously and just riding the outside of the corner.
Yeah, that was very fun to watch. It was very much a risk reward with taking attack mode. I love the way they had that set up, and Verne used it to his advantage. A solid back-to-back podiums, and Verne, after Hong Kong, it looked like his championship hopes were dead to rights. But after two wins and now this third place finish, he's right back on top of the championship standings.
Ooh, something changed. Some things stay the same.
Now, I'll tell you one driver who had a very there were a couple drivers who had tough races. There were only two retirements, but Andre Lotterer had been Mr. Consistency throughout this season, but with a battery failure 28 laps in, that's a massive blow to his title hopes after he already started 21st. So this was going to be a tough race weekend for him regardless, and now Lotterer still third in the championship, but he really needs a good performance here in Bern before we get to New York if he's to have any hope of realistically staying in the title fight.
Yeah, you're gonna have to perform. Like, this is crunch time part of the season where I still remember back to, you know, Wemmy's meltdown in Montreal. Mm-hmm. All reason why he was, you know, in that position to begin with is because he had missed the previous round doubleheader in New York.
Because of his WEC commitments, and who would he have been racing alongside him? Andre Lotterer. Yes, that's right. He would have been racing him for overall victories. Remember when the WEC was worth watching?
Yes. Though, we'll get to that news later, to avoid the shenanigans that we got during the early seasons in the in Formula E, where we had a lot of driver changes, Formula E had instituted a rule saying that you cannot change drivers during the last three races of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing some drivers kind of sending in their notices saying that kind of don't want to be in the series anymore.
Yeah, Jose Maria Lopez of Dragon is apparently going to be the first to negotiate an early exit from his contract at Dragon Racing. He had had a very tough season, and apparently he's going to be out the door before we get to Bern. Can I tell you another driver who's having, oh my God, poor one out for Alexander Lynn. This was looking like it was going to be his best day in Formula E. Of course, we talked about his struggles at DS Virgin, coming in to replace Nelson, Piquet midway through the season. And it looked like he was on pace for a very good day until the car just kind of crapped itself.
Yes, and it was something that you kind of assume that Jaguar has moved past, especially since they got their first race win earlier in the year, and that this was a big turning point for the team. But it feels like they just expanded what how good they could be, but also how bad they could be.
Yeah, it was a double non-scoring result because Mitch Brah only finished 12th from 18th on the grid. A very disappointing day for Jaguar. A good day, though, for Andretti BMW with Antonio Felix da Costa finishing in 4th and Alexander Sims in 7th, up from 11th place. Again, not quite the world beaters that they looked in preseason testing and right out of Saudi Arabia, but still a very good day, and hell, it certainly couldn't get any worse in the last season. Am I right? Sauffel Van Doorn's season starting to come around. He finished 5th, ahead of Daniel Abt in 6th. Oliver Rowland was 8th. Sam Bird, oh man, his late season slide continues in 9th. And Pascal Wehrlein in 10th, ahead of Eduardo Mortara by just half a second for that final points-paying position in 11th. Mitch Evans in 12th. Robin Friends all the way down in 13th. Matsi Gunther in 14th. Felipe Massa in 15th. Gary Paffin in 16th. Jerome D'Ambrosio in 17th. Oliver Turvey 18th. Tom Dillman 19th. Pachito Lopez in 20th. As mentioned, the only two retirements, Andre Lotterer and Alex Lynn, 28 and 23 laps in, respectively. Yeah. So how does this impact the championship standings, King? Let's look into it.
So, yes, on top of the championship is Jean-Éric Vergne with 101 points, followed by Lucas Agassi on 96, Andre Lotterer on 86th in third, Antonio Felix da Costa in fourth with 82, Robin Friends in fifth on 81, then we reach Mitch Evans in sixth with 69.
Nice.
Seventh is Daniel Abt on 67. 8th, Jerome D'Ambrosio with 65. 9th is Oliver Rowland with 63 points. 10th is Sebastian Buemi with 61. Sam Bird in 11th with 56 points. Eduardo Montara in 12th with 52. Tied with Pascal Wehrlein. Felipe Massa in 14th with 32. Sauffel Van Doorn 15th with 30 points. Alex Sims, 16th with 24, and Max Gunther in 17th with 10, followed by Gary Paffett in 18th with 8 points, Oliver Turvey in 19th with 6, then Alex Lynn in 20th with 4, Jose Maria Lopez in 21st with 3, Nelson Piquet Jr. no longer in the series in 22nd with 1 point, and Tom Dillman with 0.
Dillman, Felipe Nasr, and Felix Rosenquist, who only did the one race, all scoreless. And in the team's championship, Tachita still leads, but only by 25 points over Audi Sport in second place. Envision Virgin on 137 points. They're in third. They are just 13 points ahead of Nissan Edams in fourth. Mahindra slide down to fifth on 117. BMW Andretti in sixth on 106. Venturi in seventh on 84. Jaguar 8th on 74, HWA on 38 points, Geo's Dragon on 13, Neo all the way down in 11th on 6 points. They have not scored since Hong Kong.
Now, I'd say the Drivers' Championship is still very open. There's still 87 points left to play for.
Yeah.
So, everyone 16th or higher is still mathematically in contention.
At Matsui Gunther down. Everybody below him is mathematically eliminated. Theoretically, it's possible that you can score 87 points by maxing out with wins in all three races with pole and fastest lap, but those would be dull as shit races.
Yeah, I'd say realistically, everyone in the top five could still win the championship.
That's true. And again, this comes to Bern, Switzerland, which, again, it blows my mind that we're having circuit racing in Switzerland, and it's not a bigger deal than it is.
Yep, for the first time in a long time, the Prix de Bern is back. And apparently, from what I've heard, the circuit's a real good one. There's going to be tons of elevation change, long straights, long corners, There's some worries about car performance, but it's going to be a very entertaining race.
That should be really, really fun to watch. Again, that's the final leg of the Vosalpine European Trophy. That'll be happening on June 22nd at the Bern Street Circuit before we head to the doubleheader in New York, Concrete Jungle, Where Dreams Are Made Of, at the Brooklyn Street Circuit on the 13th and 14th of July 2019 in Ryan Eric King's backyard.
Yes,
literally. No, it's not literally in his backyard. We couldn't get that graded for FIA safety purposes.
I think I could fit one car in my backyard.
It'd be like a Scalextrics Formula League kit.
People tune in. What is this? What are we watching?
Also, I also want to shout out as well. There's a new Formula E documentary, And We Go Green, and friend of the podcast, Hazel Southwell, is in it.
Though it is unclear when us mere mortals will be able to see it, because it's still looking for a distribution deal at the Cannes Film Festival, which happened last week.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why we have so many celebrities rocking up in Monaco.
Yes, and for those who are interested in the Vosalpine European Races Cup, currently in those standings, Jean-Eric Vergne and Andre Lotterer are tied on 2 podiums each. If they score it based on how many podiums total you get during the European races. So, in theory, the only person who could win it is Jean-Eric Vergne. Because even if Andre Lotterer gets a podium, Vergne would have to not score a podium for Lotterer to win it.
It reminds me of my old European F3 German Grand Prix idea, where in place of an F1 German Grand Prix, we just scored all the European F3 rounds in Germany, and whoever scored the most was the German Grand Prix winner for that year. It's a brilliant idea, and I'm glad they took it. Congratulations, Formula E. We're going to take a quick musical break. We've got a couple other stories to wrap up here before we get on out of here with this episode. So we'll be right back after this. So we had other racing that happened. We do want to just go ahead and see, get through all that. Of course, the dead dog party of Day of Classics 4, the Coca-Cola 600. Martin Truex Jr. blew a tire early on because everybody was popping right fronts and came back to win the race thanks in large part to a 4-wide pass on the inside on the final restart. I think this is his second win at the Coca-Cola 600, because I remember him putting an almighty beatdown on the field within recent years back when he was still with Furniture Row. Yeah, and Joey Logano came one position short of Roger Penske doing the US 1100 sweep, winning both Indy and the Coke 600.
Yeah, it was, from what I saw, it was close, but, you know, Martin Truex Jr. just was able to come back and win it. besides that, that's all I know from the Coke 600, because
I was dead asleep. I was dead asleep by that point. Not because this race wasn't entertaining, but just because I had no more energy left in me. Yeah, I remember that. That was 2016, where Truex just mollywopped the field. Oh my goodness. Super GT happened at Suzuka Circuit. King, did you happen to catch any of it?
No, I plan on watching it, but I haven't gotten to it yet.
So you may want to plug your ears and hum a nice serene tune to yourself as I tell you that Tom's Racing took a 1-2 finish led by Kazuki Nakajima and Yuhi Sekiguchi in the number 36 AU Tom's LC500. That's Sekiguchi's second win in as many weeks and as many different series. And for Nakajima, of course, that gives him momentum going into his next race, some 24-hour race in the countryside of France that he won last year in a similar car.
No big deal.
Yeah, no huge deal. Ryo Hirakawa and Nick Cassidy in the other comms. Tom Scar, the number 37, Keeper LC500 in second. Kazuya Oshima and Kenta Yamashita finishing third for Lexus Team Le Mans in third place. Tough day at the office for Naoki Yamamoto and Jensen Button as they had suffered a puncture and finished outside the points. Not necessarily a banner day for Honda at a Honda-owned circuit, so as it goes. Also, Mori Onita taking his 22nd career victory in GT300 alongside rookie Senna Sakaguchi, who has only been in three races, only driven in two, and he already has two wins for his career. And he's 19 years old. And I think that had to feel a little good for him, considering he was let go by Honda last season.
Must feel fantastic.
Yeah, again, watch it. It's on the Monolith's free-to-air television service. They will also have the race uploaded into many parts. Also, can I give a shout-out as well that Super GT put together one of the first all-female broadcast teams for a motor race with their rebroadcast of the Fuji 500? Amy Ozawa and a lady by the name of Sonia, who works as an interpreter for the series, both called the race on their official English language broadcast. So that's really cool to see. We also had supercars at Winton. Scott McLaughlin is on his way to chasing history because, as it turns out, Penske's dominance extends to all corners of the world. McLaughlin took his 9th and his 10th wins of the season. There was a bit of controversy when he and his teammate Fabian Coulthard collided in the first race on Saturday. McLaughlin was told that he could rejoin the track while cutting nearly half the circuit, which he did. Fabian Coulthard got a time penalty for causing an avoidable collision. But McLaughlin had those races handily, and now he's chasing history because the record for the most wins in a supercar season is 16, set by Craig Lowndes in 1996. There's still half the season to go, unless they drop like 500 kilos of ballast into the Mustangs, McLaughlin's going to shatter this record.
Yeah, what, he has 10 wins? He just needs 6?
He just needs 6. And again, most of these are two-race sprints, so he can rack that up in just a couple weekends.
Oh, no. Yeah, he could get it done before. Well, yeah, if he wins 6 in a row, he'd get it done literally just before Bathurst.
My God. And speaking of things that are terrifying, King, you have some news from the automotive world?
Oh, yes, I do. We're on the verge of the merger of mergers.
So FCA. How good does Fiat Chrysler Renault Nissan Mitsubishi Alliance roll off the tongue?
So it wouldn't be an alliance, it would be a flat out merger FCA and Renault.
So that would effectively mean, for instance, Ferrari, Alfa Romeo, and Renault all owned by the same parent company.
Yes.
Goodness gracious.
Essentially it's not a move that anyone involved wanted to do. It's a bit of desperation on Fiat Chrysler's point, where they're trying to cut costs and they feel like easiest way to do that, just become part of another company.
Right, and of course, Renault-Nissan Alliance, let's just say it's been heavily publicized that they've been through some much better times after the arrest and disgrace of Carlos Ghosn.
Yes, and it's been estimated that the integration cost of the merger itself, before any potential savings, would be 3.5 billion euro on each side.
Oh my goodness.
It would save them 5 billion a year in the long run.
It's becoming like the Fox-Disney merger. Like, it's staggering, and it's a little bit terrifying that, you know, so many companies are going to all be owned under the same umbrella.
Ooh, yeah, where we have three F1 teams owned by the same automobile conglomerate.
That's not going to end well, I feel, because Ferrari is what's going to make the numbers in Formula One if they had to cut one of their programs.
Yeah, it'd be Ferrari plus maybe one of the other teams surviving.
Yeah, we'll see how that develops. And with that, King, have we omitted, missed, forgotten anything?
No, I think we're good.
And with that, we draw the weekend, the greatest weekend in all of motorsport, to a close. And we hope you all have enjoyed listening to all of our content, both shows, as we put them out. Again, if you haven't already, go back and listen to episode 194 as we break down everything that happened at Indianapolis with us and our friend Christopher Hardy, who is at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Thank you so much for being a part of this. Thank you to everybody who was part of Day of Classics for this past weekend as we watched Monaco and the Indianapolis 500 live. We don't blame you at all if we forgot there was an 8-hour cutoff. We were just having that much fun at the end of Indy.
Yep.
And of course, you can find all of our work at motorsport101.com. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We are on Facebook.com at motorsport101, YouTube.com/motorsport101. We're at Twitter at motorsport_101. And if you want to follow our personal handles, you can at Harrison101HD, at RJ O'Connell, at Ryan Eric King, that's with two Ks. And with your financial support, patreon.com/motorsport101, all of this magic comes to you. For $5 a month, you get early access to all of our shows. For $10 a month, you can listen in as each show is being recorded. And we'd like to thank all the wonderful people who've come out and listened to us live. Again, thanks so much for being part of everything that was Day of Classics. We know we'll never be able to top this again for the rest of the season.
Yep. Shut down, come back next year.
Oh, goodness. So what do we have next weekend? We have the duel in Detroit. We have MotoGP in Rossi Land and Mugello. We're never short of excitement here. We're just going to pick right back up on it. All right. So with that out of the way, for Andre Harrison and Ryan Eric King, I'm RJ O'Connell. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Motorsport 101, and we'll catch you next time. Later, y'all.
Bye.